Hey, here we are again for another episode of Old School Guns. This is actually episode 27. Wow, to think that there's almost 27 hours of this podcast out on the out there on the net. Well, actually, I usually record less than an hour. It's normally about 45 to 52 or 53 minutes. So there's not quite an hour out there for each one. So there's safely, though, there's probably a good 25 hours out there. So anyway, we tell you like it is. We don't really pull any punches. We don't give anybody a break. We don't let anybody off the hook. If something's garbage, we say so. If something's great, we say so too. So if you like what you hear, please hit the follower button, hit the like button, whatever button you can push on the platform that you're listening to this on. And that way you'll get a notification when the next episode is posted. So let's get right into it. First of all, a couple of folks have noticed that it always sounds like I'm gasping when I'm doing this. Part of that is because I talk kind of fast, because I want to talk clear and hold people's attention. I just don't like the slow, droning business that you hear other places. The other thing is my $11 microphone, sometimes it doesn't really record with the greatest clarity, but it will pick up whenever I'm breathing in between sentences or words. So it sounds like I'm gasping, but I'm really not. I did have some respiratory stuff going on the first few episodes, and so I did. My voice was kind of scratchy. I had some allergies and a few things, so I was a little bit scratchy then. But everything is a-okay. I can assure you. Okay, let's get right into the news. As of course, as you well know, you'd have to be living on another planet to not know that there were two shootings over the weekend. One in El Paso and one in Dayton, Ohio. And these things are very, you know, they're horrible. I mean, they are absolutely horrible. And, you know, it tends to smear gun owners. There's 300 million people in the country, and at least half own guns, probably even more. And so when you get the random crime like this, which is not representative of the population, it's not representative of gun owners, it's not representative of who we are as a people, but when this happens, the overreaction is, well, it's the guns are bad, the people, you know, and this wouldn't happen if we didn't have guns. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, something would happen. Terrorists find a way to kill. They do. Remember the Christmas market in France, and there was also one in Germany where they just drive semi-trucks through it. And you say, well, a 19 or 21-year-old who's you know, upset because he never fit in school, probably isn't going to be that guy. Well, you know, he could be. If people are angry enough, they will find a way to kill. One of the things I have to tell you is I've been in that Walmart, the one in El Paso. And I have to tell you, it was not a very nice place. The people were very nice, but it was a dirty, kind of very low-income Walmart. I mean, you know, normally Walmarts, you know, at least the floors are nice and everything else. This one didn't even have nice floors or anything. You know, it just looked dirty and wasn't clean. We were there on some business. Some people I was traveling with needed to get some stuff from Walmart. And frankly, I wouldn't buy anything there because it just didn't look clean to me. So, you know, there's like cleanliness in restaurants or places where I buy my food. Or buy some food, have to look, you know, like they're well-kept and decent. So this place did not. It was a very kind of a low income right off the freeway there. Kind of El Paso is kind of a strange town, if you know it. There's mountains and kind of in the middle of the town and everything. So it's a little bit strange. But anyway, just to go over that, you know, that's the type of thing that should never happen. But the people who were against guns before these mass shootings, or shootings, however you want to characterize them, the people who've been pushing for gun control all along are seizing upon this as a way to advance their agenda. And what I have to tell you is, you know, they're not just after guns. These aren't a bunch of people who just don't like firearms or have a sound belief. that firearms are the cause of these nightmarish crimes. They're coming after your guns. They're going to take those. They're going to come after your money. They're going to take that and they're going to redistribute it to whoever they see fit. They're going to come take your freedom for other things. They're going to take your First Amendment rights, which they're trying to take now. They're trying to take everything from you. I mean, their agenda is out there. They're socialists. They're going to take what they can take from you, and they're going to give it to somebody else to fulfill their own dreams of utopia. And without guns, you're not going to be able to stop them. And I would tell you that if they get in power, the guns aren't going to stop them anyway. I've often felt that the government is not afraid of your guns. The government has vast resources, even though a lot of people might defect, and in the law enforcement and military, they should never count that those people are going to come seize guns and everything else. But, you know, the government has a lot of power currently, you know, face it. They can eminent domain you out of your house and just say, here's some money and you got to move. And they can do all kinds of things to you. I mean, they have the power to put you in a judicial process that can incarcerate you. They've got all kinds of power. And these socialists want to take that power and use it more. I mean, you saw what happened in the Obama years where they weaponized the IRS to go after conservative groups. And you can see where they weaponized the FBI to go after a presidential candidate that they just disagreed with on policy. And they weaponized the Justice Department to basically put forth this kooky Mueller investigation, which, you know, it's a laughingstock, it's a farce. But don't think for a minute that these things are all unconnected and they just happen. No, they are trying one thing after another to take you. And they want after, and they don't care what color you are. They don't care what language you speak, or if your parents were immigrants or not, or if you're an immigrant or not. They don't care. They don't care. You represent the haves in this country. If you're listening to this podcast, and in my life, you know, if people who consider me a have don't know very much about being a have, or don't really know, aren't too clear on what a have is, or aren't too familiar with haves, but to a lot of people in this country, if you have a job that allows you to purchase a modest home, if you have a car, and or two cars, because normally families have to have two cars now, if you have, you know, the television and the cable service, you know, the things that we kind of consider the nice basics to have. You know, you have a home, you want internet service, you want television, obviously heating and cooling, you know, all those things. In a modest home, hey, guess what? You're a have to them, and they're coming after you. And Ocasio-Cortez, Tlaib, Omar, and even maybe, I don't even know if this moron Presley is even a socialist or if she's just stupid. They're going to come after you, and they're going to take everything they can take from you, and they're going to hand it to people who just walk into whatever port of entry or come across the border or declare themselves a refugee or say, hey, I want free stuff in America because it's better than no stuff or having to work for stuff somewhere else. That's what this country is going to become, and we cannot afford. You think if they do single-payer health care and give health care to everyone, guess what? There isn't enough health care to go around. So you who are the worker who have earned health care and who pay for health care, you're not going to get your fair share of health care. You're going to get what they apportion out to you. And the older you get, the less you're going to get. Because they're going to say, hey, you're a bad investment. You're 60 years old. You're probably going to live till 80, 85. But we're going to give it to somebody who's 20, 25. And guess what? That might be a person who doesn't work. That might be a person who doesn't do anything constructive. And you're going to work and pay for that person's health care. And that's fundamentally not the way the United States was ever envisioned of working. And if you're a healthcare professional, you're going to go from a person who's highly trained and makes a good living, in some cases a very good living, you know, I can't imagine being a neurosurgeon. Those guys and gals deserve to make a lot of money, because I can't imagine operating on somebody's brain, just having the knowledge to do that and even the confidence to do that. You know, you can only learn, you know, at a certain point you're going to get into a real person's head and do a real operation, and you know, you just hope that the training is there, and evidently it is, because we have people who are successful neurosurgeons. So those people are going to become somewhat diminished, and why would somebody want to do that if they're not going to get financially rewarded for it? I mean, that's part of the incentive, and smart people can figure out other ways to make money, and they can figure out other things to do. It's not like we can draft people and make them doctors, nurses, and all these other things that we need to do. Same thing with the drug companies. I mean, I don't like paying for high prices for prescriptions. I don't. I have a plan that basically softens that pretty well. But you know, somebody pays it, and some of that money they take goes into profits, because a profit-making company is a profit-making company, and some of that money goes into research and development, so we have better medicine to give people, you know, in the future, and improve the medicines we have. I mean, everybody wants the top-rated stuff, but we just can't go hand it out. The country won't work. Nobody will have it. It'll collapse. And nobody really wants to see that happen. I mean, nobody wants to be taxed literally to death. Nobody wants to be held up as and just robbed of everything you earn. Take stuff away from your family. Take stuff away from your kids. You know, how would you feel? You can't buy your kid a bicycle. You can't buy your kid things for Christmas. Things that you earn. You know, you work and you earn, and you say, hey, you know, I want to see a smile, you know, at the Christmas tree. Well, you're not going to see that if these people have their way. They're coming for you. They're coming for your money. And good God, all of us better do what we can to fight back against that. And the best thing is, get involved in the political process. Get rid of these people and get them out of our lives. Get them out of the news, get them out of our lives. And we do that by voting them out, because you know what? Election wins are the currency of social movements. And so, you know, when somebody gets voted out, they're done. That's a judgment that's been passed on them. So vote them out, work against them, vote them out. Don't let them get away with this. On a related subject, we have Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's a astrophysicist. He's a man of education, letters, and you know, I'm not one of those kind of people. I can't just sit around and wondering what's beyond the next star. That's just not me, you know, because that's something that these theoretical people can do, you know, people who just live in the theoretical and can come up with these ideas on how the universe works and all that. And I think that's very good. A lot of it's very interesting. He's put out some very interesting things, written a lot of books, but it's not my interest. But I did see his tweet, which he's since been excoriated for and forced to apologize for. And he essentially said this in response to these two shootings over the weekend. In the same, we lost 34 people in 48 hours to these two shootings. He said, in the same 48 hours, we lost 500 people to medical errors, 300 people to the flu. That's really amazing. I didn't know that flu deaths were that high. 250 to suicide. Yeah, I knew suicide rate was about 200 a day. Yeah. So 250 seems like that's right in the ballpark. 200 to car accidents, and I will tell you, just as a quick tangent, I was driving to work one day and I saw, you know, this car had hit the back end of a semi trailer, an empty semi trailer, but it was pulled by a semi truck. It was a long flatbed trailer, and of course the deck of the trailer had hit the windshield of the car and completely crushed the passenger compartment. And in fact, I knew it was a fatal accident because they had a tarp over the area where the driver was. So clearly his remains were still in there. And there's emergency vehicles all around, and it's a pretty hectic scene. But I actually had to search for that story in the local news. I mean, it just was not, when somebody's killed in a car accident, it's not considered that big of a deal. Now, if that person had been shot, if he had been waiting at an intersection and someone pulled up next to him and shot him, that'd be almost national news. It would be probably a national news story. But we have many more people killed in accidents and killed in preventable accidents, and it's a real shame. I mean, it just goes unnoticed by society in general. If this had been anybody else and had there been a firearm involved, it would have been big news. I guarantee it would have been big news. You see it on these news feeds all the time, woman killed standing outside of bar or some other kind of thing, or woman killed at bus stop or something. And you find out that it's some random, or it's some gang shooting gone bad, and the person's a bystander or whatever. And these things are all bad. But they will hit national news when in fact traffic deaths are unreported. And I would say during the you know during that same 48 hours, what was the death toll just in Chicago homicides, or Baltimore homicides? But anyway, to round it out, and there are in 48 hours across the country 40 homicides with handguns. Okay, that's probably about right in a country of 300 million people plus 320 million people. That's probably it. Of course, what that does not tell you is that gun violence has been cut in half since the 1990, the rate, and not just the incidences, but the rate per 1,000 people. So we actually are living in a society that's becoming safer from firearms, and there's less gun misuse now, half the gun misuse now that there was in the 1990s. So we're in a much safer society. But you would never know it listening to the mainstream media, which is just, it's Pravda. It's left-wing Pravda is what you're listening to there. And so when Dr. Tyson puts this out, he wasn't downgrading anybody, but he just says, hey, we just tend to go after the shiny thing, and we don't tend to look at the real data. And he is correct. And I think there's even more data out there. I think the leading cause of child fatalities, it's probably car accidents, but I know drowning is right up there. I mean, especially children under 5. Drowning, they get in the water, and that's a real problem because they just can't swim. Although I've seen things where they can teach babies to swim, but it's easier to teach a baby to swim than a toddler. But that, and the fact of the matter is, you can talk about 40 homicides by handgun, but a lot more people are killed with blunt objects and knives than are killed with rifles in this country. So, and that's even factoring in what they call mass shootings. And now they're trying to say that, in some of these domestic things where somebody kills off his parents or kills his siblings or kills his wife and brother-in-law, that anything more than a single homicide is now being classified as a mass shooting. And that's simply done to facilitate gun control. That's not done for anything other than propaganda purposes, to further roll back your Second Amendment rights, my Second Amendment rights, and go after our free speech rights. And it's gonna come to, they're gonna take your money, you're gonna work, and it's gonna be for the betterment of the collective, which is indeed socialism, if not worse. Okay, well, I think we've spent enough time on that, almost 20 minutes. But going back to our famous thing, we can now go back into some other things. One of the outdoor websites was talking about our favorite thing, bear attacks. And they actually had a link to an article that described a fatal grizzly bear attack last year. And that kind of got me to thinking, when we talked about bear attacks, we really were talking about black bears. And we said that, grizzly bears are a different thing. But You know, a black bear, a large black bear can weigh, 250, 300 pounds. Large grizzly bear can weigh substantially more. And in fact, a grizzly bear cub can weigh 150 to 200 pounds, which is really almost the size of a lot of black, it is the size of a lot of black bears. So, there's degrees of bear. There are degrees, just like there's Yogi and Boo Boo, and Yogi was a lot bigger than Boo Boo. Well, this is the same deal here. The grizzlies are a lot bigger and a lot meaner. And this was a particularly interesting case. It was a professional hunter who was guiding an archery hunt, and it was for elk. And what they were doing was they, on the evening, it happened in September during the season. And they shot an elk, and the animal got away, and it was too dark to track it. So the next morning, they pick up the blood trail and they follow it, and they find the dead elk. And the elk had not been chewed on or killed by a bear or eaten by a bear, eaten on by a bear. The carcass was not damaged by that in any way. So they knew that no bears had been around there and hadn't gotten it. Well, while they were cleaning the elk and field dressing it, because an elk is pretty heavy, you just can't, take the intestines and all that out. You normally have to quarter it and get it into transportable chunks so you can move it back to where it can get processed. So while they were doing that, the guy, they had only one firearm with them. And it was a Glock pistol. We'll get to that later. Guy took it off, and they were working with the elk, and somehow they either the way that the cub had acted or the way it got they wound up in between a female grizzly and a cub. And now they didn't move there; they were kind of there. But I think the cub must have circled around one way and. Therefore, they wound up in between it. So the mother freaks out and goes after these guys and picks up one guy and just throws him. And he hits the ground, he's stunned. Then it goes after the guide, grabs him. He no longer has his gun on him, but he's able to reach it with one hand and throw it to the other guy, the hunter. Who did not know enough about the gun to be able to chamber around, and therefore the guide was killed by the grizzly bear before this guy could even get a weapon into play, and he never got the weapon into play. Now that sounds very tragic and very preventable, but I would say that I don't know that it would have ended up any differently other than maybe putting a few pistol bullets into the bear, and I don't know what effect that would have had. But the hunter survived, and I guess he was shaken up and probably bitten up a little bit. Not mauled really badly, but he was hit hard enough, and the other man was killed. And so, here's the real lessons. I mean, they talk about lack of preparedness. Obviously they weren't going to get a bow. they weren't going to get a bow. Into action fast enough to do anything. The first thing probably is, look at your situation, look at your immediate environment. I can't believe that these bears just snuck up on them. The mother and the cub just completely snuck up. These guys were focused, where their hands were. They weren't looking around, and they really should have. Somebody should have been on watch, and it probably should have been somebody who could have a gun and handle it. Now, I would also say that a Glock pistol, 10 millimeter, for black bears would be sufficient. 40 Smith and Wesson might be sufficient. 45 ACP, yeah, maybe sufficient. 357 SIG might be sufficient. Talking about black bears, but if you're in grizzly bear country, I would not rely on a handgun at all. I would have had a pump 12 gauge. That would have been my short range weapon, and perhaps having something that was even more powerful would be wise. you know, maybe some kind of a large hunting rifle that could be fired quickly. I don't know exactly. You can theorize what those would be, but those things have to be ready. You have to have a round in the chamber and the safety on, and just flick the safety off. You can't be fumbling around trying to figure out how to put a round in the chamber, and a pistol round at that. So you have a weapon that's probably insufficient for the task. It's not in readiness, and the second member of the party, the guy who had eventually got tossed to, didn't know how to operate it because he's a hunter and probably not a gun enthusiast. I guarantee he's not. So there you go. Prescription for disaster. And even if they'd gotten the Glock pistol into action, I don't know with an animal that big that a Glock pistol is what I would have had. Clearly, anyone, you know, if you're going to have a handgun, and I would have a handgun as a backup maybe, you know, you're talking about a 454 Casull. You're talking, you could make an argument for 50 Desert Eagle. You could make an argument for Smith & Wesson 500. You can make an argument for any of the Super Magnum 480 Ruger. There's a whole broad variety of choices out there. And those would have been a much, much, much better choice. Now, the handgun itself is not an optimal choice. But if they had those kind of each one had one of those kind of handguns in addition to a pump shotgun, they might have stood a chance. And even if they only had one shotgun in between the two of them, but they were each carrying the handgun and were competent with it, they would have been much better off. But it's a sad situation. The other thing is, no matter what they were armed with, somebody had to be on watch, because even though you may not have seen a bear for weeks or months or even years, if you're in bear country, they can be around. The other things that can be around there too are mountain lions, and a mountain lion could have easily done this kind of damage too. They're a large animal. They can get on you. They can kill you with a bite. You know, if it bites you on the head or the neck, you're done. And you know, if it wants that elk meat, it's going to go. But remember, we talked about bears, and you start getting September. You know, those things are, hibernation is not far from their little small minds, and they're getting all the calories they can. They smell that dead elk, and they're just not going to let two hunters keep them from it. And especially with the dynamic that the cub was somehow had gotten on the other side of these guys, so they were de facto in between the mother and the cub. All of that is just a prescription for disaster. And even if they'd been totally prepared, somebody might have gotten hurt, but they probably would have both survived. If they could have gotten a handgun and a shotgun into action, maybe somebody gets bitten, maybe somebody gets mauled a little bit, but he could have survived, because the other one would have been pumping rounds into this bear and would have eventually disabled it or killed it. So, you know, everybody talks about the bear attack guns. Well, it's more than just about guns. It's about vigilance. It's about situational awareness, which is really the best weapon you had. Maybe, even if they'd seen the bear coming and all that, maybe if they both split the area, you know, even if they're running away, maybe the bear will go to the dead elk and let those two guys escape, especially if they can get up a tree or get into a place that the bear can't get to. So, anyway, that's the big grizzly bear attack. You know, it's a frightening thing to think about, because you don't think about that in the American woods. We think about that in Africa, where there's leopards and all kinds of things that'll hurt you, rhinos and Cape buffalo and elephants and large animals that can kill you. We don't really think about that too much here in North America, but it definitely can happen. Okay, here's a couple other things. Shooting the Brownells Retro AR, what a great rifle, absolutely great rifle. Brownells has done a first-rate job. As I said before in previous casts, it's as good, if not better, than anything Colt put out. And I've got a Colt SP1 that's in really nice condition, and I think the Brownells is actually a better made gun. As it came from the factory, the windage was set perfectly. I think I put No, I didn't even have to adjust the windage on this one. I did have to adjust the elevation. The sight was up a little too high. And of course, that meant that the rifle was shooting low. So when you turn the sight down and the sight actually goes lower in the sight post, that will raise your point of impact. That's how that works. Now, granted, you can, they always say you can use a point of a cartridge to do that. That sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. I had a screwdriver kit, and I used a little punch to push the detent down, and then I have a front sight adjustment tool. Since I couldn't get one from Shotgun News, I got some, or not Shotgun News, Sportsman's Guide. Excuse me, apologies to Shotgun News. Sportsman's Guide wouldn't sell me one years ago, but I've gotten one since. So I've adjusted it, and it's shooting exceptionally well. The sights are great. They're easy to see. It is like shooting an A1. I have really started to like the charging handle, the trigger charging handle on the top of the receiver. Every once in a while, I still find myself reaching for where the T handle is. Old habits die hard, and I don't think they'll ever die with me because I'm used to ARs, and I shoot a few other ARs, so I'll never be completely converted. But boy, it is convenient, and it's really nice. The only thing I've noticed, and it's not really a negative thing, it's just something I've noticed, is Brownells puts heat shields in the handguards. The handguards are kind of a heavy polymer. I would say plastic, but that gets everybody all offended. But they're a heavy polymer, and it does not have all the all basically all the ventilation holes. The top of the regular AR triangular handguards. The AR-15, early AR-15, and the M16A1 handguards. They had all those. It was almost scalloped all the way down, so that you had all these holes that the heat could come out of and dissipate out of, and it had some on the bottom too. The Brownells has got a few round holes in it, but not nearly as many. And plus, I think that the fiberglass that the triangular fiberglass handguards dissipated heat a little better. So what I'm really telling you is that in just kind of slow, controlled fire, no real rapid fire, nothing radical, I could feel the front end from about 4 or 5 inches down from the gas block, the 4 or 5 inches of the handguard heading back towards the receiver. They did heat up. They did heat up. Not uncomfortable. I mean, you noticed it, but not uncomfortable. I normally shoot with at least a light glove on anyway. I'd like to do a lot of my shooting with gloves on because the old operator in me, that's kind of the way I did it, and I like protecting my hands if I'm doing something else besides shooting or in addition to shooting. So I did notice a little heat buildup there. What I did not notice was heat buildup where the trigger charging handle is, that top slot along the top of the upper receiver. I did not notice any heat there. So, take that for what it's worth. There have been Your mileage may vary. I think a few other people who've tested it in range TV, I think, found some heat coming up near the trigger. I think that's where they found it. But I didn't find it there. I found it somewhere else. Very accurate. Shoots 55 grain American Eagle 5.56 ammunition exceptionally well. And the iron sights, thank goodness, are very clear, very easy to use. And that's good because there's no way you can put a scope on this bad boy. That's the other thing. The iron sights are the iron sights. They are the sights. And there's no real option there. I suppose you could. It does take a standard AR-15 front post. So you could put in a colored post or some other, if there's some other little deal there. But the rest of it is stock GI, just like the M16A1. A very, very good sighting system, very practical. I'm very impressed with it. I'm very, very impressed with it, and I think that anybody who buys it will be too. But anyway, that's just part of the ongoing evaluation of a new product, and want to give everybody information as I discover it. Okay, here comes my favorite part of the podcast, and that is questions and answers. Okay, the first question is, why does anyone use revolvers anymore? I took that down the way it came in. So to phrase it perhaps a little more clearly is, what is the practical use of, or why would you use a revolver? What is the advantage of a revolver over the higher capacity semi-automatic pistols that are available now? What's the deal with a revolver? Is it nostalgia? What is it? And I would have to say that unreservedly, it's power. Although that's not always the case, that's not exclusively the case, but power is a good reason. Most, especially, you know, if you take the super magnums there, hey, the only things you've got there are Desert Eagles and a few other things, which are very, very excellent pistols, but you're going to pay a pretty hefty price for those. You can usually get a powerful revolver for about half the cost. So that's one reason. Another reason, and this is why I like revolvers, are, hey, I don't have any magazines to mess with. You know, it's got a cylinder and it's got a cylinder. I do use half moon and full moon clips in my 45 caliber revolvers, my 45 ACP revolvers, when I'm too lazy to load any 45 auto rim ammo. But, you know, even that is that was a brilliant system 100 years ago, and it's really a brilliant system today. So I like it. I don't have a lot of extra junk to buy. I'm usually pretty happy with the grips as they come from the factory. And, you know, most manufacturers are putting pretty decent grips on their guns now. It used to be that the first thing you did was chunk the old grips in a drawer and put on some Packmeyer grips or something else. Now everybody's going through the drawer because those old grips are worth money and putting them back on. But so it's you have very few accessories to buy. It is what it is. I mean, it's powerful, it's reliable. And frankly, you know, we talked about that bear attack, you know. Hey, here's a guy who's not a gun enthusiast, and he's fumbling around, doesn't know how to chamber around in this Glock pistol, while a few feet away from him, his friend is getting killed. So with a revolver, you know, I saw a bumper sticker one time. Hey, it's the original point and click interface. So you point and pull the trigger, click, and you have an interface. You are sending a bullet somewhere. So that's why a lot of people like them for defense, like them for CCW. You know, there's nothing to fumble with. There's no, it is what it is. And with factory ammo, as reliable as that is, I've rarely, if ever, seen a factory revolver round disable a revolver. I've rarely seen that. Hand loads, yes. Because a hand load that does not have a powder charge will push its bullet into the forcing, in the area between the forcing cone and the barrel, and effectively tie up the revolver. And then you're out of action. It's a club at that point. It's a big clumsy set of brass knuckles or something you can just beat somebody with. Because you have to take a cleaning rod and a little hammer and tap it back from the muzzle end to get that out of there. But that rarely, I've never actually heard of that happening with factory ammo. Now, I'm sure it has somewhere, someplace. But if you buy, especially if you buy high quality factory ammo, and we all know that there's factory ammo and there's factory ammo. And so if you're buying the really premium self-defense stuff, you're not going to have that problem. Your gun's going to go bang every time. And that's part of the advantage of a revolver. Is its intimidation factor any better? Well, I don't know. I don't know anymore. I don't know that any gun, I would rely on any gun's intimidation factor, because it appears that the bad people now aren't as afraid of handguns as they used to be. But I will tell you this, the first couple of guys that get hit by a 454, they will become believers, and they will be afraid of handguns after that. And same thing with a full plus P44 Magnum or you know, a few other things that will turn them into believers. You know, maybe a 38 or a 9mm doesn't quite have the power to do that, but they will become believers if they're hit by a 454 or even a 45 Colt, you know, will do pretty much some serious damage. So that's why people use revolvers. I really like them. I like them to the point where I even shoot cap and ball revolvers. So they're just a great fun recreational tool, and they have real defense applications that really can't be ignored. You really can't ignore it. Okay, why is the M4 the preferred version of the M16? And again, I took that directly. I'm going to try to clarify that by saying, why did the U.S. military go away from the standard M16 as we knew it in the M16A2 and go to the M4 carbine? And I will answer that. It's a much more convenient and much more agile weapon to use. It possesses the right amount of killing power vis-a-vis size. It's in an era where we ask our infantrymen and our special operators to carry 75 to 100 pounds of lightweight equipment. You know, if you can save a few pounds on the rifle, have a shorter, more compact, quicker rifle to bring to bear, those are great advantages. The M16A2 is a great rifle. It's really, well, first of all, the M16A1 and A2, the reason those are gone is because they had carry handles, and we don't like carry handles anymore because we like having the rail on the top so we can mount all the good stuff. So those were going to be gone because of that, and the M4 was the first real generation widespread to have that rail on top. And then they've gone back to special mission type things and DMR rifles that are like an A2, but they do have the flat top. They don't have the carry handle, but they do have the 20-inch barrels and heavy barrels and in some cases free-floating handguards and all the kind of goodies that people are using now in military service. So, but for the very basic soldier, a very convenient, a very quick-handling weapon is excellent, and that's what the M4 carbine is. And it really is a masterful weapon out to 300 yards. I mean, it's flat shooting. You don't have to worry about it's almost too easy. You know, you put, especially when you put a hollow sight or an aim point or an EOTech on there, you know, the first round hit ability is incredible. And that's why we were, you know, kicking serious butt in Iraq. And I think we had similar success in Afghanistan. I mean, we could hit those guys so frickin' fast. And you can even test it yourself if you have access to an SKS or an AK. Just time yourself. You know, go from a position of where the gun's not on your shoulder, or you're not sighting down it, but where you're holding it, and shoulder the rifle, look down the sights, acquire the target, and squeeze the trigger. Put an aim point. Use the iron sighted SKS or AK up against the optically sighted or optically aided M4, and you see the massive advantage that gives you. I would even say that if two people see each other almost identically, and you say, well, that never happens, somebody's going to see somebody first, you'd be amazed. You turn the corner, and everybody sees each other equally at the same time, and it's surprise, surprise, but the person who can get the first shot wins. The person who can get fire superiority wins, and that's what the M4 is really, really excellent at. And that's one of the reasons I don't think it's been replaced. I mean, yes, there's been XM8s and SCAR lights and all this, but until a weapon can really do that, really give you a decisive first shot advantage that the M4 does not currently possess, I think it'll be a very, very tough chore to try to displace the M4. Okay, here's a great one. I had talking about British guns with somebody. What is the accuracy of a 577 Snyder at 100 yards? The true answer is I haven't the foggiest idea because I've never shot a 577 Snyder. However, I did research this a little bit. And they go about 4.5-5 inches with good ammunition. I'm assuming a good marksman with good eyes. You know, those rifles were never designed to be target rifles. They were designed to have an advantage over the muzzle loaders they replaced. They did that. They look like a hoot. I mean, they look like they are fun to shoot. It's a great big, you're shooting essentially a 60 caliber ball that's loaded into a brass case. I mean, what could be better than that? I mean, what really could be better than that? And I think they put 60 or 70 grains of black powder behind it. So, what could be better than that? But it is not going to shoot tight groups. It is going to shoot large groups. But if you're hitting something like the lid of a garbage can or something at 100 yards, you're going to be banging it and making all kinds of noise and having great fun. Okay, what is the most underrated military bolt action rifle cartridge? And my first thought was 7mm Mauser, because I said that, you know, if you had to choose in 1930s, if you had to equip your army with bolt action rifles, really a great thing to do would be give them 7mm Mausers the way they shoot. But 7mm Mausers, very famous, very well known, and a lot of people hold it in high esteem, so it's not underrated. 6.5 Swedish, not underrated. 6.5 Japanese was a good round in the Nambu light machine gun. I don't know that it was all that great in rifles. It seems like the Japanese dumped it and went to 7.7 because they weren't lethal enough. So I would not say that that's underrated. I would say it was probably from their perspective underperforming. So about the only thing I was thinking about this, and really the one that jumped to my mind is 7.65 Mauser, which is 7.65 by 53, commonly known as 7.65 Argentine or 7.65 Belgian Mauser. It was in the first successful Mauser rifle, came out in 1889. The Belgians adopted it, used it through the First World War and a bit beyond, probably into the Second World War also. The Argentines used it in a series of rifles. I think it was first the 91, a great rifle, a great rifle. The 1909, a friend of the podcast has that rifle, and it is a sweet shooting rifle. It is really nice. The 1909 Argentine may be the most underestimated or underrated military bolt action. Maybe one of the ones. But the cartridge itself, it's excellent. It basically has the same ballistics as a 7.62 by 51 NATO. The package is a little bit different, but it was basically the 7.62 by 51 before the 7.62 by 51. So a great cartridge, and it would have been a great machine, and it was in machine guns for Argentina and the other countries that used it. It was in machine guns. A great cartridge. I think they did the FN-49 in it. And I think that was kind of the last hurrah. It would have been very interesting. I don't think you would notice any difference between a 7.65 Argentine FAL and a 7.62 NATO FAL. I don't think you would have noticed the difference. So it's a great cartridge and very underrated. No reason for it now. 7.62 by 51 NATO is basically overshadowed it. But in its day, but it was there in the 1890s. And it was really ahead of its time. You could argue that it was two generations, or it was 60 years ahead of its time. Great cartridge. Okay, most underrated military handgun cartridge. And that is a toughie. That is really tough. I think the most underappreciated is probably 45 ACP. I think it's a great cartridge. The countries that have used it have kind of gone away from it. But I really think it has a lot of advantages, and you know, I'm maybe it's just being a traditionalist, but I'd rather carry a 45 ACP than a 9mm. I mean, I just would. So that's, you know, give me a SIG 220 and 45 ACP. Yeah, that'd be sweet. That'd be a sweet a duty gun to have in a combat zone, I think. Anyway, so 45 ACP you could say is the most underappreciated, but most underrated. And you gotta really look around because 9mm around and you could say 9mm Largo because it's kind of like 9mm, but it came out after it, so it's not really that. I would have to say the most widely used but underrated cartridge would have to be, in my mind, 38 Special. U.S. military has essentially used it in some capacity or another since about 1900. And they started, I think, maybe 1905. But, you know, they've always kind of had a few there. And never really used it much in World War I, but used it a lot in World War II, a lot during the Korea, Vietnam, Cold War. 38 Special was there. Aviators carried them. We've mentioned the Air Force had the Smith & Wesson M15, which was the Smith & Wesson Model 15 combat masterpiece. I remember seeing Army aviators. They all had a 38. So I even remember seeing what we would now call a PSD for a kind of a high-value guy. And he was armed with a World War II Victory model. You know, he has one bodyguard, and it's a guy who's got a Victory model Smith & Wesson with no extra cartridges, by the way, just the six that were in the gun, kind of that Barney Fife moment, you know. But that was around. I would say that's the most underrated because it was around, it was used. And nobody really talks about how good it was, but it apparently was just fine. Like most military handguns, they're fired in anger very, very, very rarely. But, you know, they're a good confidence builder. That's something you just have to have. You don't want to be caught somewhere, and especially if you're like an aviator, you don't have a long arm with you in those days. And, you know, so the handgun is what you have. And we equipped our naval aviators and then later our Army helicopter aviators. And I don't know what they carry in jets. I assume it was kind of the same thing. But anyway, I'd say it would have to be 38 Special. That is the only one that makes sense to me. A couple of honorable mentions would be 380 ACP. You could kind of do like what the Italians did, which is kind of make a small gun that you could conceal, but you could also carry for a duty gun in the Beretta 1934, 380. Not the most powerful, but concealable, so you could get dual use out of the same one, pretty good. 32 ACP, because ballistically, I don't think there's practically a whole lot of difference between that and the 380, if any really discernible difference when you're shooting it. And those were around police and people were using those up into the 1970s. I'm sure there were some in military use. There certainly were in the communist bloc. The Czechs were using the CZ-50s and 70s for one thing or another. So I think there are some police, but probably some military use also. So, you know, 32 ACP would probably be my runner-up. 38 and 38 Special as the most underrated. And the two honorable mentions are 32 ACP and 380 ACP. Well, anyway, that brings to a close another episode of Old School Guns. Remember, hit the like button, hit the follower button, and you'll get a notice when our next episode is posted. And until then, this is Old School Guns out.